you know, in celebration, here you go. Wow. Can Kanye be my friend? VOA One, the hits.
Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners. So we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. Katie Weaver and Mario Ritter bring us the education report. They talk about how the COVID-19 pandemic is causing a sharp drop in international enrollment at colleges and universities in the United States. For this week's Words in Their Stories, Gregory Stockel tells us about words dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. We will finish our 30 minutes together with The Making of a Nation, our ongoing U.S. history program. But first, the education report.
Sai Nani of India is just 2 terms short of completing a master's degree program in the United States. The 28-year-old studies cybersecurity at the University of Toledo in Ohio, or he used to. Last summer, Nani had to leave school suddenly when his father became very sick with the disease COVID-19. He reached the hospital in India just 4 hours before his father died. He was emotional. He was in tears, Nani said. I think he was waiting to see someone who would take care of my mother, and then he left. 2 months later, when Nani was ready to return to the university, U.S. officials denied his visa request. He said the only explanation he got is that the decision was based on guidelines they received from the White House. Everything changed, Nani said. The goals I had changed. The milestones I had changed.
Problems and new policies brought on by COVID-19 have stopped thousands of international students from attending U.S. colleges this year. The sharp drop could lead to long-lasting effects in schools that depend financially on international students. At risk are millions of dollars in tuition payments and some of the world's best minds for U.S. employers. The number of new international students has been falling in recent years because of rules limiting student visas and competition from other countries. But COVID-19 has been a crushing blow. New international student enrollment in U.S. universities this term is down by 43%. That number comes from a new study of more than 700 schools. The nonprofit Institute of International Education reported the findings. The group has been publishing data on international enrollment since 1954. The study found total international enrollment, including new and returning students, fell by 16%. And it showed that among those who did enroll at U.S. colleges, about 1 in 5 were studying online from outside the United States.
Some of the nation's largest universities experienced a big drop in international students. The number of undergraduate and graduate international students at Michigan State University was down 20%. The University of Texas reported a drop of 17%. The state university systems in Arizona and Ohio each said that foreign student enrollment shrank by 15%. Administrators agree the pandemic created barriers for students, from job losses and financial difficulty to worries over U.S. government policies. Universities were flooded with questions from concerned parents. They wanted to know where their children would live if colleges closed student housing. They wanted to know what would happen if their child got sick. Some students decided to stay home because of those worries. It all has forced students to make difficult choices. One University of Toledo student decided not to go home, even when two relatives died of COVID-19, said Tracy Hidalgo, an official with the school. "They just bawl their eyes out and tell me no because they're worried they're not going to be able to come back," she said.
Adding to the problems of the health crisis are worries about changes to U.S. immigration policy. Experts say there is a growing belief that the country is no longer as welcoming for international students. "The combination makes for a very difficult situation," said Leonardo Villalon, head of the University of Florida's International Center. "International higher education is under the greatest stress it has been in decades." The drop in enrollment will be felt in budgets at colleges because foreign students usually pay higher tuition than in-state students. The University of Illinois alone estimates it will lose about $26 million this term. And high-tech companies will suffer. They depend on foreign-born people who come to the U.S. for training, Villalon noted. "Where do we want the best and brightest young people in the world to go?" he said. "If you're running a research lab studying the coronavirus, you want the very best in there." There is hope among some college officials that President-elect Joe Biden will overturn some Trump administration immigration orders as promised. Biden also has said he would seek a new pathway to citizenship for foreigners who complete U.S. doctoral programs. U.S. universities are also facing increased competition from countries, including Canada and Australia, that are appealing to foreign students. And China is heavily investing in its colleges.
Usman Bari is a Guinean refugee who moved to Italy. He won an academic scholarship to Whitman College in Washington State. Bari was to begin classes at the school last summer, but his visa request was turned down because he could not show enough ties to his home country. He still has hope that he will get another chance. "Going to the United States to study is the best," he said, "because of all the educational possibilities it offers." I'm not trying to work or spend my life there, said the 21-year-old. All I'm looking for is a better education, and then to go back to my country. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
And now, Gregory Stockel brings us this week's Words and Their Stories.
In today's Words and Their Stories, we will talk about words from the health crisis that affects all of us this year. Gwendolyn Nichols is with Cambridge Dictionary. She said the words that people search for reveal not just what is happening in the world, but what matters most to them in relation to those events. The events of this year have sent people to search for words like coronavirus and COVID-19. It also brought words that we rarely used in the recent past, such as quarantine, lockdown, and pandemic. So what did Cambridge Dictionary choose as the 2020 word of the year? The answer is quarantine. Cambridge said searches for the word increased in March when many countries went into lockdown to stop the spread of the new coronavirus. The word has also taken on a new meaning, and Cambridge has since added to its definition. It now says quarantine is a general period of time in which people are not allowed to leave their homes or travel freely so that they do not catch or spread a disease. Collins Dictionary, another British publisher, chose lockdown for its word of the year. It said the word represents a uniting experience for people across the world. The publisher noted that lockdown was originally a word connected to prison life. When prisoners riot or cause other trouble, guards will lock them inside their cells to help return order to the prison. In 2020, Collins said under lockdown, normal public life is suspended, and we see few people in fewer places. The meaning of the word has changed in people's mind. Lockdown is now a public health measure. On March 11th, the World Health Organization declared the coronavirus crisis a pandemic. At a news conference that day, the World Health Organization's Director General said, "Pandemic is not a word to use lightly or carelessly." The Merriam-Webster Learner's Dictionary says pandemic is an event in which a disease spreads very quickly and affects a large number of people over a wide area or throughout the world. Both Oxford and Collins said pandemic received consideration as their word of the year. The Oxford Dictionary, however, did not select pandemic or any single word as its word of the year. Oxford Dictionary officials said 2020 is not a year that could be described in a single word. So, it decided to look at words as they changed throughout the year in a Words of an Unprecedented Year report. It was bushfire in January when more than 200 fires were burning across Australia. In February, everyone was talking about the impeachment of U.S. President Donald Trump. The month of March brought coronavirus, followed by COVID-19. Then came lockdown, social distancing, reopening, hand sanitizer, coverings, and super spreader. In June was the month for Black Lives Matter after American police killed Black citizen George Floyd in late May. Mail-in saw increased usage in August as Americans looked for ways to vote safely during the pandemic. In 2019, Merriam-Webster chose they as its word of the year. The word they has no gender and can be used in place of he or she. The American Dictionary publisher has yet to choose its word of the year for 2020. However, the online betting website Sportsbook Review says the word COVID-19 is the heavy favorite to become Webster's word of the year. And that's Words and Their Stories. I'm Gregory Stockel.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. President Abraham Lincoln led the Union of Northern States in 4 years of civil war against the Southern Confederacy. But he did not live to see the end of the war. He did not live to see the nation reunited. He was assassinated in April of 1865. Shep O'Neill and Morris Joyce tell what happened after Lincoln died.
Almost immediately, officials began planning details of the president's funeral. They asked Mrs. Lincoln where she wanted her husband buried. At first, she said Chicago. That was where the Lincolns were going to live after they left the White House. Then she said the Capitol building in Washington. A tomb had been built there for America's first president, George Washington, but it had never been used. Finally, she remembered a country cemetery they had visited. At the time, her husband had said, "When I am gone, lay my remains in some quiet place like this." So Mrs. Lincoln decided that the president's final resting place would be in the quiet, beautiful Oak Ridge Cemetery outside their hometown of Springfield, Illinois.
For several days after Lincoln's assassination, his body lay in the East Room of the White House. The room was open to the public all day. Next, the body was taken to the Capitol building. Again, the public could come to say goodbye. Then the body was put on a special train for the trip back to Illinois. 4 years earlier, President-elect Lincoln had traveled by train from Illinois to Washington. He stopped to make speeches in cities along the way. Now, on this sad return trip, the train stopped at those same cities: Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, Cleveland, Indianapolis, Chicago.
In every town, people lined the railroad. They stood silently with tears in their eyes as the train moved slowly past. Farmers working in the fields saw the train and dropped to their knees in prayer. For the wise man who had led the Union through 4 years of bloody civil war, Father Abraham, was dead. Churches throughout the country held memorial services. ministers told their people that God had taken Lincoln because the president had completed the job God had given him. He had brought peace to the Union and freedom to all men.
The final service was at the cemetery outside Springfield. It ended with the words from Lincoln's second inaugural speech. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in. Let us heal the nation's wounds. Let us do all possible to get and keep a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations.
While the nation mourned Lincoln's death, federal officials investigated his assassination. The man who had shot Lincoln in Ford's Theater was an actor, John Wilkes Booth. He had fled the theater after the murder. The government offered a reward of $100,000 to anyone who captured Booth and his helpers. The investigation produced the names of several people who were friends of Booth. One was John Surratt. Like Booth, he supported the Southern Confederacy during the Civil War. Another was David Harold, a young man who worked in a store in Washington. Others were George Atzerodt, Louis Payne, Sam Arnold, and Michael O'Loughlin. Most of these men had stayed at a house owned by John Surratt's mother, Mary.
One by one, in the days following Lincoln's death, these people were arrested. Anyone else who might have had a part in the plot was seized. Soon, hundreds of suspects were being held in jails in and around Washington. At the end of a week, only two of the plotters were still free, David Harold and John Wilkes Booth. Booth broke his leg when he jumped from the presidential box to the stage at Ford's Theater. A few hours later, he and Harold stopped at the home of a Dr. Samuel Mudd. They reportedly gave the doctor false names. They asked him to fix Booth's broken leg. Dr. Mudd agreed, and he let the two men sleep at his home. Federal troops chasing the assassins arrested the doctor. They accused him of being part of the plot.
John Wilkes Booth and David Harold ran and hid for 6 days. They crossed the Potomac River from Maryland into Virginia. Finally, 12 days after the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, soldiers found the two men. They were hiding in a tobacco barn near the town of Port Royal. Harold agreed to surrender. He came out of the barn with his hands in the air. He shouted again and again that he was innocent. Booth refused to come out. The soldiers set fire to the barn.
The fire forced Booth to move close to the door. The soldiers could see him now. He was aiming a gun at them. The soldiers had been ordered to capture Booth alive, but one of them raised his gun and shot Booth in the neck. The actor fell. Some of the soldiers ran to the burning barn and pulled him out. They carried him to a nearby house. He died 2 hours later.
John Wilkes Booth carried a notebook. He wrote in it every day. On the day Lincoln was killed, he wrote, "For 6 months we had worked to kidnap Lincoln, but with the Confederacy being almost lost, something decisive and great must be done. I struck boldly." Booth described how and why he had shot the president. "Our country," Booth wrote, "owed all her troubles to him, and God simply made me the instrument of his punishment." Booth's body was returned to Washington. Men who knew him confirmed that it was the body of John Wilkes Booth. The body was buried under the stone floor of the Washington prison. A few years later, his family received permission to move the body to a cemetery in the city of Baltimore.
Evidence showed that only a few people were actually involved in the plot against the president. Most had agreed to work with Booth because they believed he planned to kidnap Lincoln, not kill him. Of the hundreds of persons arrested, only 8 were brought to trial. The Secretary of War decided that they would be tried by a military court. He argued that Lincoln had been commander-in-chief of all military forces and had been murdered during wartime.
The trial began almost 2 months after the assassination. The prisoners seemed in poor condition. All wore heavy chains on their arms and legs, and the men had been forced to wear thick cloths over their heads. Officials said the cloths were necessary to prevent them from talking to each other. The Secretary of War announced that the prisoners could not meet privately with their defense lawyers. They could meet only in the courtroom. Guards could hear everything they said. One of the defense lawyers recognized that the job was hopeless. He said the trial was a contest between the defense lawyers and the whole United States. There was no question, he said, what the military court's decision would be.
The government tried to prove that Lincoln's assassination was a Confederate plot. Witnesses told how Confederate supporters reportedly planned to cause trouble in the North. But none could prove that Confederate President Jefferson Davis, or any other Southern leader, played a part in Booth's plot to kill Lincoln. 400 witnesses appeared. Many of the important ones had been arrested as suspects. They agreed to give evidence if the government dropped the charges against them. For 6 weeks, the court heard evidence against the 8 prisoners. The prisoners themselves could say nothing. They could only listen.
In late June 1865, the trial of Abraham Lincoln's assassins ended. The military officers serving as judges met secretly for 2 days. Then they announced their decision. All 8 prisoners were found guilty. One received a prison sentence of 6 years. 3 were sentenced to life in prison. 4 were sentenced to die. Defense lawyers appealed for mercy. The appeal was rejected. On July 7th, David Herold, Louis Payne, George Atzerodt, and Mary Surratt were hanged for the murder of Abraham Lincoln.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world.